Thanks for tuning in for the March 10th podcast. I'm Bob Gross, editor-in-chief of the Neurology family of journals. This week's featured interview showcases a discussion of enterovirus as the cause of acute flaccid myelitis. In the What's Trending segment, you'll hear an interview on anti-epileptic drugs and cognitive dysfunction. Please remember that we offer free CME for each eligible podcast. Simply find the Neurology podcast episode online and click on the CME quiz link. We offer up to 60 hours of CME for past shows, all available online on the same webpage. It's easy and free for AAN members.
This is David Lapidus with the University of Virginia. Today I'm speaking with Michael Wilson and Ryan Schubert about their paper Panviral Serology Implicates Enteroviruses in Acute Flaccid Myelitis, published in Nature Medicine, October 21, 2019. Michael Wilson is an associate professor of neurology at UCSF Weill Institute for Neurosciences, where he specializes in infectious and autoimmune disorders of the central nervous system. Ryan Schubert is a clinical fellow in MS and neuroimmunology at UCSF and first author on this paper. Ryan, if we could start with you. As you write in your paper, since 2012, there's been a spike of cases of acute flaccid myelitis. Do we now know that enteroviruses cause acute flaccid myelitis?
So we know now that most patients with AFM, really more than 90%, had a respiratory illness or fever before they developed AFM. And we know that viruses like enteroviruses are common. And we think with our study showing that, you know, over 70% of cases have antibodies against enterovirus, we feel confident saying that enteroviruses cause most cases of these AFM patients.
Great. And Michael, this question's to you. We've previously discussed metagenomic sequencing on our podcast on the September 10th, 2019 episode. But can you remind us a little bit about this new technique, keeping in mind we have a largely clinical audience?
Sure. So the technique that we've been publishing on for a few years is the metagenomic sequencing assay, and that's focused on, in an unbiased way, querying all the nucleic acid, RNA, and DNA in a spinal fluid sample to try and identify unusual or unexpected infections in patients with meningitis or encephalitis. And the tool that Ryan used in this study is a bit different. We know that in many neuroviral infections, the titer of the virus and spinal fluid can be quite low. And for viruses like West Nile virus, the virus may only be present for a few hours or a couple of days in the CSF. So in that case, a direct detection test like metagenomic sequencing that requires some of the RNA or DNA of the microbe to actually be present in the CSF sample that's being sequenced, those techniques can be insensitive. And so that's why Ryan spent a lot of time developing a version of this VIRSCAN assay that was originally published by the Ehlich Lab at Harvard, which is a panviral antibody detection tool to help complement the direct detection tool that we have with metagenomic sequencing.
Great. Michael and Ryan, I believe your work represents a paradigm shift in the way that we evaluate for infectious causes of nervous system disorders. And while panviral serology described in the paper here represents a research tool in its current form, metagenomic sequencing offers clinicians an amazing tool. Yet I found when I asked my antimicrobial stewardship team to send blood or cerebrospinal fluid to your lab, we're often faced with the question, how will this change management? Sometimes the answer is, I don't know, or if we're in between infectious and autoimmune etiologies, perhaps we wouldn't administer an immunosuppressive therapy. Do you, Ryan, have any thoughts on how to address this common question?
Yeah, that's a great question and one that we certainly get all the time. I think that it's still very much a research test. And so we have to be careful not to overinterpret the results because we do generate, you know, each of us antiviral antibodies all the time. And so I think at present, we really need to think about this tool as something where we can discover potentially either new viruses that are causing neuroinvasive disease by seeing antibodies that haven't been seen before, or as a way to really detect an outbreak that may be occurring. But in these particularly challenging cases, I think we've certainly seen some interesting results in some of these types of cases, but I would say it's still a ways away from the clinic at present. And so we really appreciate getting samples from our collaborators so we can start really addressing those questions and generating the data that we need to answer them better in the future.
just to chip in a little bit on the metagenomic sequencing assay and give some perspective on that. So the metagenomic sequencing assay is now clinically available, and we continue to evaluate, you know, what the optimal role for it is in evaluating patients with neuroinflammatory disease. But I think some helpful rules of thumb in terms of how it can or can't help with management. I think certainly if a patient still has very active inflammation in the CSF, and either if there is the suspicion for an active ongoing infection that hasn't been identified yet, or in the case potentially of a patient for whom, you know, the pendulum is swinging and people are considering an autoimmune encephalitis condition, but they just want a little bit of extra reassurance that they haven't missed an occult infection, metagenomic sequencing assay can be potentially a helpful rule out, as long as people remember that, like any diagnostic test, it's not perfect and it has some caveats. And in the paper we discussed in the last podcast, some key caveats to remember in terms of things that can decrease the sensitivity for the metagenomic test, or if a patient looks like they have a compartmentalized infection, like an abscess, there may be very little to no nucleic acid from the bug in the spinal fluid, so it can be insensitive in that situation. If it's a remote infection, again, like we talked about, and the nucleic acid for the bug may have just gone a week or two prior to when the latest CSF sample is obtained, it may be insensitive. And similarly, the patient has a very high white blood cell count, you know, thinking of over 500 or 1,000 cells in the CSF, then there can be so much kind of human genetic material in the CSF that that can make the detection of non-human sequences more difficult. Not impossible, but more difficult, and a negative result has to be interpreted with caution.
And so metagenomic sequencing can provide further reassurance to rule out infectious etiologies, recognizing that there are some limitations of the technique, including high white blood cell counts, abscesses, or timing of the collection of the sample. So, Michael, do you treat patients with new onset acute fosfomyelitis with anything like antiviral treatment, steroids, IVIG, or plasma exchange?
So I'm not a pediatric neurologist, and I know there's differing opinions on how to manage these patients because we don't have a lot of evidence one way or the other. I think this study and other work that continues to point to virally mediated damage in the central nervous system suggests that antiviral strategies like with IVIG are probably more advantageous than some of the attempts to really acutely lower the inflammatory response with high-dose steroids or plasma exchange. I know that's controversial right now, but as we get more and more evidence that this is a virally mediated disease, I think lowering the immune system may make less sense over time.
Wonderful. Well, I really congratulate you both on this exciting, really revolutionary work in neuroinfectious diseases. The work represents a collaborative effort between UCSF, Chan Zuckerberg BioHub, California Department of Health, the CDC, University of Colorado, Boston Children's, Mass General, and the University of Ottawa. Again, I've been speaking with Michael Wilson and Ryan Schubert on their paper, Pan Viral Serology Implicates Enteroviruses in Acute Flaccid Myelitis, published in Nature Medicine, October 21st, 2019. And if anyone would like to listen a little bit more from Dr. Wilson on metagenomic sequencing, please listen back to the September 10th, 2019 podcast. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Hello, this is Hallie Alexander from Wake Forest University. Today I'm speaking with Emma Foster from the Royal Melbourne Hospital and Monash University in Australia. We're discussing her recent article in Neurology titled, Anti-Epileptic Drugs Are Not Independently Associated with Cognitive Dysfunction. Emma, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
So in this study, you and your colleagues were evaluating the influence of anti-seizure medications on cognition. What did you learn about that relationship?
Well, we wanted to examine whether individual anti-epileptic drugs impact cognitive function above and beyond other clinically relevant factors. So firstly, we divided cognitive function into two categories, objective cognitive function, that is how well patients perform on validated neurocognitive assessments, and secondly, subjective cognitive function, that is how patients perceive and self-report their cognition. We performed an observational cross-sectional study of 331 patients admitted to an inpatient video EEG monitoring unit over a 7-year period. Our patients completed questionnaires regarding quality of life and mood disorders and completed a screening test for objective cognitive function. When they came into the epilepsy unit, about half were on anti-epileptic drug polytherapy, a quarter on monotherapy, and a quarter were not on any anti-epileptic drug. We found that predictors of objective cognitive function were increasing age, increasing seizure frequency, and concomitant diagnoses of epilepsy and psychogenic non-epileptic seizures. And we found that the predictors of subjective cognitive function were depression, anxiety, and increased seizure frequency. But when we analyzed the anti-epileptic drugs individually, none were independently associated with impaired cognitive function above or beyond other clinically relevant variables.
Excellent. So the predictors you found of worsening cognition did not really have anything to do independently with the anti-seizure medications, but for the objective findings, they were associated with increasing age, seizure frequency, and a concurrent diagnosis of non-epileptic spells and seizures. And then for the subjective findings, like we might expect, depression, anxiety, and then again, seizure frequency.
Absolutely. And this is, of course, an observational study, not implying causation, but looking at predictors or associations.
Okay, so the patients who were evaluated in this study were all patients who were admitted to the epilepsy monitoring unit, as you mentioned, for the evaluation. So is there anything unique about these patients in this study that might caution us against overgeneralizing these results?
Yeah, so look, these patients, as you say, were admitted to an epilepsy monitoring unit. They were adults and their ages range between 18 and 77 years old. They had many different types of epilepsy with varying degrees of severity, and many had refractory epilepsy mandating their admission with difficult to control seizures. So because this cohort only included adults, these results may not be generalizable to children and adolescents with epilepsy. And in addition, many of the patients in this study were on the more severe end of the epilepsy spectrum, so these results may not be generalizable to broader epilepsy cohorts.
Okay, so then in light of those possible limitations to the generalization, I know the question that's probably on a lot of people's minds is that many neurologists are in the habit of counseling patients about cognitive side effects of our epilepsy drugs when we prescribe them. So do you think the results of this study mean that we should counsel patients differently?
Look, not necessarily. I think many factors contribute to impaired cognition in people with epilepsy. In our large and very heterogeneous cohort, anti-epileptic drugs were not found to be independent risk factors for impaired cognition, but it's definitely possible that some individuals may be more susceptible than others to anti-epileptic drug-related adverse cognitive effects. As yet, we don't have a robust way to predict who these patients will be. I think it's still good practice to make patients aware that some people experience adverse cognitive effects from anti-epileptic drugs, but it needs to be emphasized that it's unlikely to be the sole reason for their cognitive impairment. And patients and clinicians need to keep in mind that other issues such as poor seizure control or unrecognized or undertreated mood disorders are also important factors for impaired cognition.
Okay, I think that's a great point that, you know, even if it might be affecting cognition in some way, making sure that they're aware that it's probably not the sole contributor and focusing on things like treating the seizure frequency itself may actually improve cognition more than stopping the medication. So that kind of leads to my next question, which you addressed a little bit, but it's kind of the flip side of the other question is, say that you have a patient that you're taking care of who's already on an anti-seizure medication and he thinks it's helping his seizures, but then, you know, comes in saying that he thinks it's causing some cognitive slowing. So you touched on this a little bit, but what do we do in this case? Is there any sort of algorithm that we follow? Do we start by obtaining formal neuropsych testing in order to try to decide whether it fits in that objective or subjective category? And at what point do we consider changing the medications, if at all?
That's a great question. So in this study, the self-reported or subjective cognitive concerns were strongly predicted by depression, anxiety, and seizure frequency. But on the other hand, we didn't find a strong predictor with anti-epileptic drugs for this subjective cognitive complaint. So I think in the clinic, if the patient comes in and self-reports cognitive issues, a very good first step is to screen for mood disorders. This can be done relatively quickly with a validated screening tool. We use the Hospital Anxiety and Depression Scale, or the HADS, in our study, but there's many other screening tools available. It would also be really important to consider whether the patient's cognitive complaints arise from subtle clinical or subclinical seizure activity and subsequent postictal periods. So to investigate this further, clinicians may arrange for prolonged EEG monitoring. This could be done in an ambulatory setting or during an inpatient admission. Certainly, I think it's reasonable for formal neuropsychological testing to be organized, but our study found weak correlation between subjective and objective cognitive function. In addition, there's often a considerable wait period for neuropsychological testing, so it would be good practice to screen for mood disorders and uncontrolled seizures in the meantime. I think many factors need to be considered before changing medication, so particularly if there's any concern that there may be uncontrolled seizures, an increase rather than a decrease in dose may be needed to result in improved subjective cognitive function.
Okay, yeah, I think that's a great point too. So the kind of rough algorithm you've outlined then is to firstly consider screening for mood disorders with a brief mood screening tool, then consider whether seizures or subclinical seizures could be contributing, which may require getting either an ambulatory EEG or some long-term inpatient monitoring. And then, you know, considering doing the neuropsych testing, but taking into account that that could actually take some time to get scheduled and get the results back. Did I summarize that appropriately?
Exactly. Yep.
Okay, great. And then before we go, how have your interactions with your epilepsy patients changed with regards to their cognition after you completed this study?
I found it really interesting that patients' self-reported cognitive function only weakly correlates with their objective cognitive function. So for this reason, I now approach cognitive function in two ways. Firstly, what does the patient self-report? And secondly, what do the objective tests show? And I think treating cognitive impairment in this way is important as they're associated with different factors. So for patients who have subjective or self-reported cognitive impairment, I now regularly screen for anxiety and depression. And I also target questions on history taking for symptoms that may indicate ongoing subtle or nocturnal seizure activity. If that's suspected, I arrange for admission to our video EEG monitoring unit. Uncontrolled seizures is also important to check for patients with objective cognitive impairment on neuropsychological assessment. And for these patients, if that's determined, more rather than less antiepileptic drugs may be needed.
Great, thank you. This is a topic that definitely comes up frequently in patients with epilepsy, so it's great to have a little more evidence to help guide our clinical management of epilepsy patients with cognitive concerns. Our listeners can find the full text of the article in this week's issue of the Neurology Journal. Again, the article is titled, Anti-Epileptic Drugs Are Not Independently Associated with Cognitive Dysfunction. Thank you again, Emma, for speaking with us today.
Thank you very much.
This is Bob Gross. Please check out this week's journal, which features an interesting article on management and outcome of primary CNS lymphoma patients in the modern era, and another article on increased mental health care use by mothers of children with multiple sclerosis. Please take a look at these and other articles this week. Thank you again for listening, and have a great week.
The views and opinions of the participants in this podcast do not necessarily reflect those of the journal Neurology or the AAN. Disclosures of the participants are included in the show descriptions, reached by a link on the neurology.org website.